please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Morning.
Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, good morning. May it please the court. Appellants collectively own 7-year warrants to purchase 603,369 shares of common stock of United Artists Theater Company for $10 per share. Appellants obtained the warrants through highly contentious negotiations in connection with the bankruptcy reorganization of United Artists. This appeal is from a January 16, 2004 decision of the Chancery Court under Chancery Court Rule 12b-6, dismissing appellants' 3 claims for breaches of the warrants and tortuous interference with the warrants. Appellants' 3 claims arise from a business combination involving United Artists and 3 other companies controlled by United Artists' controlling stockholder, Defendant Philip Anschutz. Appellants allege that Defendant Anschutz, as United Artists' controlling stockholder, used a selective exchange agreement and subsequent short-form cash-out merger as a 2-step scheme to selectively allocate the value of United Artists in the business combination to favored holders while shortchanging and eliminating non-favored holders of identical interests. In March 2002, Anschutz and selected others entered into an exchange agreement pursuant to which the selected holders of the 4 Anschutz-controlled companies exchanged their stock warrants and options for new stock warrants and options of a newly formed corporation, Regal Entertainment Group. Only selected holders of United Artists stock and warrants were permitted to participate in the exchange agreement. However, the exchange agreement provided for an exchange of all of the United Artists stock and all of the United Artists warrants, but only by Anschutz or Craig Slater, another United Artists director, and required all of the exchanges to take place prior to the Regal IPO. The exchange agreement also provided for an exchange of all of the United Artists management incentive options for new Regal incentive options. Anschutz exchanged his United Artists warrants for approximately 4.2 million new Regal warrants. By the time of the exchange agreement, Anschutz had increased his 58% control of United Artists to approximately 85% by acquiring additional United Artists common stock from other minority holders. Following execution of the exchange agreement, but prior to the Regal IPO, Anschutz acquired and exchanged additional United Artists common stock, bringing the total by May 2002 to just barely above the 90-plus percent required to effect a short-form merger. Prior to the short-form merger, the operations and management of the 4 companies, including United Artists, were combined and integrated. Also, 4 of United Artists' directors joined the Regal board, and most of the IPO proceeds were used to pay off United Artists' term credit facility. The short-form merger at $14 per United Artists share was effected on August 16, 2002, with United Artists as...
Excuse me. We've read the briefs. I think we have a working knowledge of the facts. It might be better use of your time to focus on the legal arguments, unless you think continuing with this recitation of the facts is going to help us understand your legal argument.
Very well, Justice Holland. I'll proceed with addressing the implied covenant claim. Count 1 of the amended complaint is for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Appellants recognize this court takes a cautious approach to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The legal test for an implied covenant claim, as articulated in Katz versus Oak Industry and as cited by this court in Cincinnati SMSA, is whether it is clear from what the parties who negotiated the contract expressly agreed upon that had they thought to negotiate with respect to the challenged conduct, they would have proscribed it. Citing Wilgus versus Salt Pond, the Chancery Court in this case correctly observed the implied covenant is breached when defendant engages
in... Let me interrupt you for a minute. There, I understand that there are 2 provisions of the agreement on which the plaintiffs rely as a basis for relief. One is the tag-along provision. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. The plaintiffs don't rely on the tag-along provision. The tag-along provision was one of the contractual provisions cited by the Chancery Court as a basis.
They don't claim rights under the tag-along provision.
The plaintiffs do not claim.
Do they claim rights under the anti-destruction provision?
Yes, in count two of the in count two of the amended complaint.
That's so the count one then is basically a claim that by not including the minority, what became the minority stockholders of United Artists in this deal to exchange all the United stock for the Regal stock and then take Regal public, that was a violation of the duty to perform a contract in good faith?
Your Honor, the
yes?
No, that's not a complete recitation of the claim, Your Honor. The claim deals with the disparate treatment of the identical warrants held by the plaintiffs versus the warrants held by Anschutz in a two-step scheme, the two steps being, the first step being the exchange agreement.
Well, your clients were not treated as well as other warrant holders who were identically situated. Isn't that your claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And isn't that claim cognizable, so you argue, under the doctrine of the implied contract of good faith, that is, the duty to perform a contract in good faith?
Indeed, Your Honor. That is the claim.
Okay. And what is the contract?
That
there was an obligation to perform in good faith so as to treat equally all the warrant holders?
The warrants themselves, Your Honor. And the warrants were negotiated to be identical with the warrants obtained by Mr. Anschutz.
So if Mr. Anschutz selects an arbitrary percentage of the warrant holders to benefit from this Regal deal and leaves the rest to be cashed out, he can't do that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Certainly at the price that Mr. Anschutz determined to cash out the Regal the remaining warrant holders. That's correct.
All right. And isn't that claim in reality a fiduciary duty claim rather than a good faith obligation to perform a contract claim?
It's not a fiduciary duty claim in the sense, Your Honor, that it is according disparate rights to holders of identical interest, which we claim is a contract claim for the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. With respect to the minority stock,
it could have been a fiduciary claim, could it not?
It could have been on behalf of a stockholder, Your Honor, or a party to whom a fiduciary duty was owed. Yes, it could be, Your Honor.
But those claims have been abandoned.
The fiduciary duty claims in this case, Your Honor, dealt with what
appears. They have been abandoned.
They have been. Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
So that if this is not, that is, if the disparate treatment is not a violation of the implied covenant of good faith, then there's no claim, at least under that count.
Under count one. That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Kreiner, let me ask you a hypothetical that your opponents think really is this case, but for our purposes, let's consider it a hypothetical. And in the hypothetical, imagine that five people have warrants, and someone like Mr. Anschutz decides he'd like to do business with two of them. And in order to get two of them to stay in business with him in the future, he said, you can put into this enterprise your warrants, and we'll go forward and I'll exchange consideration in the new venture for the warrants. Now that leaves the other three warrant holders standing there with their warrants. Why wouldn't a person be allowed to do that? To say, I'm going to go into business with two people who happen to be warrant holders and let them use the warrants in consideration for the new venture?
Your Honor, the distinction between that case, I think that is a much different case. And if I can point out the distinction with this case, whether or not that would be absolutely prohibited, I don't think that necessarily would be. If that's dealing with putting the warrants into another company, the difference between this case and Your Honor's hypothetical is that the appellants allege here a two-step scheme that was concocted together, that the Anschutz warrants and holder the interest of selected holders would be provided with the treatment under the exchange agreement, and the non-favored holders would be cashed out. And if if Your Honor's hypothetical included a second step as part of this scheme to cash out the non-favored holders at an unfair price, I think that would move into the rationale that's being applied by the appellants here.
So it's the coupling that concerns you, and what the Vice Chancellor concluded is, if you could do step one, even if you had step two in mind, if you could legitimately do step one, and that's what he decided, then when we get to step two, we're really looking at whether you received what you were entitled to, and your argument when we get to step two is that your client should have received the functional equivalent of an appraisal.
That's right, Your Honor. After having participated in the business combination and understanding the first step of the business combination, United Artists was not free then in the second step to turn around and declare that the identical warrants were worth only essentially $4 per warrant, less than half of the value we contend.
Well, let's look at them separately, then put them back together, which is the way you want. As I understand the Vice Chancellor, he's saying step number one was totally appropriate, and you agree that would be true in the abstract. The difficulty is combining it with step number two, and the reason that the Vice Chancellor concluded step number two was also permissible is because pursuant to the terms of the warrant, as the Vice Chancellor construed them, they got what they bargained for. Now, my question for you is, but for the combination of the two steps, do you say that step two provides for the functional equivalent of an appraisal, or is it as a result of the combination of steps one and two that this appraisal remedy becomes operative?
Under count two, Your Honor, if that's what Your Honor is referring to, the count two claim applies regardless of whether the two steps are linked.
Okay.
In count one, the implied covenant claim depends on the court's adopting the allegations for purposes of the motion to dismiss that the two steps were linked, and plaintiff's allegation is United Artists was not free after the first step to declare that the identical warrants were then entitled only to $4 per warrant.
And how do you respond to the Chancellor's analysis on page 28 of his opinion, where he says 2C isn't written in a manner that reflects an intention to get the equivalent of a 262 appraisal?
The bottom line response on that, Your Honor, is that appellant's interpretation of 2C is that the fair value which a stockholder obtains through appraisal is the entitlement, and that is the ultimate entitlement. The fact that the warrants do not incorporate procedural steps as appraisal should not be dispositive. In fact, in the Continental case, the provision at issue didn't include any provisions relating to perfection, or was not written in the sense that one would contemplate the specific procedural steps of appraisal. And also in Continental, the court dealt with a similar argument that was made with respect to the employee option. It was argued that the employee option, that by definition American General could not ever be an employee, and therefore it couldn't satisfy the employment requirements of the option, and therefore that American General could not be entitled to the option.
If the specific language in the warrant is shares or other securities or property, and you go from those words to fair value, and that's what the Vice Chancellor had trouble with. So how do we read shares or other securities or property and get it to mean fair value?
Your Honor, the appellants read Section 2C to be the shares or other securities or property to which a stockholder is entitled upon consummation of the merger. And we read the entitled in a broad sense to include fair value as well as the merger consideration, because in reality, particularly in a short-form merger, the entitlement to fair value is fundamental to a stockholder.
Aren't you really making two separate arguments? The first is that the claim, that is the right to seek an appraisal, as a consequence of Section 253, is a species of property for purposes of the anti-destruction clause?
Your Honor, we're not claiming that the contract provision here, the warrant provision, gives standing to a warrant holder to move into Section 262 and assert appraisal rights.
All right, let me rephrase it. There are two arguments that you're making. Perhaps they're not separate. Perhaps they're coupled. The first is the one that I articulated. The second is that the purpose of the anti-destruction clause in the warrant is to put the warrant holder in the same position that the warrant holder would be in had he or she exercised the warrant immediately before the merger. Had that been done, then that warrant holder, now stockholder, would be entitled to seek an appraisal in lieu of accepting the consideration for the merger. Correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So in that sense, that contingent sense, the right to seek an appraisal would be property. Is that the position?
That's correct, Your Honor, and the right to obtain fair value under the statute. That's correct.
All right. If it is your position that the anti-destruction clause is designed to equalize the position of a warrant holder that actually exercises the warrant and one that doesn't, would it not follow that if you're right, that your clients would not be able to accept, to receive the cash, the $14, if that's what it was, that was called for as the merger consideration? That is, it would have to elect either to take the cash or to seek a quasi-appraisal.
Your Honor, you're absolutely correct that if Section 2C was to put the warrant holders in exactly the same position as the stockholders, absolutely the warrant holder would have to make an election, as does a stockholder under the procedural rubric of Section 262.
Your position, as I understand it, is that the warrant holder would not have to make that election, but can have it both ways. That is, take the money and also seek a quasi-appraisal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that undermine the very premise of your argument?
It doesn't, Your Honor, in the sense that our argument is that the entitlement to fair value is the ultimate result of the appraisal proceeding, and that the offer of the merger consideration based price for the warrants is something that the stockholder is entitled to for the term of the warrant, and the right to seek fair value, to the extent that fair value is more, arises by virtue of the bundle of rights that comes to a stockholder.
I hear the words, but not the meaning. If the purpose of the anti-destruction clause is to put the warrant holder in the identical position as an actual stockholder who was cashed out, then on what principled basis can you argue that the warrant holder can keep the money and also seek an appraisal or the equivalent of it?
Your Honor, merely based on the breadth of the definition of the rights under Section 2C, and that we contend that the entitlement also includes fair value. Understandably, Your Honor, absolutely, if Section 2C is interpreted to put the stockholder exactly in the same position, or the warrant holder exactly in the same position as the stockholder, it does not include a provision for a choice. That's correct.
To be fair, you didn't indicate at the beginning whether you wish to reserve rebuttal time. You have a minute and 40 seconds left. Do you want to reserve that?
Your Honor, I have indicated that I wish to reserve three minutes for rebuttal.
Well, you didn't indicate it to me or to us.
I apologize.
So
I apologize.
You have a minute and 25 seconds.
I'll reserve that, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. This is the time set for the argument in this appeal, and we thank the Court for hearing us today. I wanted to introduce to the Court briefly my colleague, Susan Wood, from Morris Nichols. who was instrumental in putting together the papers. Your Honor, this is an appeal from a well-reasoned decision from Vice Chancellor Strine. There were three claims in the case. First was that the allegation that United Artists breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing that adhered in the warrants that the plaintiffs purported to hold. Second, the plaintiffs have an express breach of contract claim, that is, that the merger that was done by United Artists back in August of 2002 breached the anti-destruction provision in those warrants. And third, the plaintiffs alleged the non-United Artists defendants committed tortious interference with the plaintiff's contract rights by engaging in the merger that had happened.
Well, Mr. Lafferty, let me ask you kind of a bottom line question, and then we can go back to the two parts. It seems what the plaintiffs are saying here is that your client very astutely put a transaction in place that resulted in a short-form merger, which by definition did not have to provide fair value because shareholders who are cashed out that way can always have an appraisal, and that his client signed up for warrants, and basically at the end of the day, they were treated unfairly because the process that was put in place that resulted in this short-form merger gave them consideration that the shareholders could get, which by definition could be less than fair value with a take-it-or-leave-it, no alternative by the equivalent of an appraisal. And as I understand it, your argument is that both steps were permitted as a matter of law, and if you didn't protect yourself by putting in the appropriate remedy, then that's what you're left with, even if what you got was less than fair value. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And let me step back, because I think there are a couple of key factual points that play into the legal arguments that have been made here today and that I am about to make. First of all, the contractual rights that the plaintiffs got through both the warrants and the stockholders agreement, which Mr. Kreiner says they don't have a claim under that, but the stockholders agreement is very relevant to the overall negotiations and the rights that the plaintiffs have. These negotiations were highly contentious. The plaintiffs themselves are very sophisticated investors. They're so sophisticated that they themselves put United Artists into bankruptcy through an involuntary bankruptcy filing. So these were very heated negotiations. They were represented. They took care of themselves in these negotiations. This is what they got through those negotiations. What they want here today is to have the court rewrite those agreements and give them rights they didn't get at the bargaining table. So that is exactly what we're here about. Now, backing up to the transactions that were at issue, Mr. Anschutz and his companies, and remember that Mr. Anschutz acquired controlling interests in three other companies besides United Artists. There was Regal, there was New Generation Network, and there was Edward Cinemas. And he owned a majority interest in all of those companies, and he put his interest together under one controlling enterprise, a holding company, Regal Entertainment Group, which he then anticipated he would take public. Now, that decision on his part to exchange his shares, into Regal stock, and other shareholders participate in that, not only just United Artists shareholders, but the shareholders in Edwards and in the other entities that became part of Regal, that was a privately negotiated transaction. United Artists was not a party, importantly, to that contract at all.
I don't understand, Mr. Lafferty, that the other side contests the proposition that Mr. Anschutz was entitled either to sell his control in United Artists outright or to transfer that control to an entity which he then took public. The problem was that in addition to that, he selected some but not all of the United Artists warrant holders to get involved in that Regal deal. The first claim is that to do so constituted a violation of the implied covenant to perform a contract in good faith. Is it correct that your side's position is that covenant, that doctrine doesn't apply because the tag-along clause, which could have been drafted to cover this situation, did not?
Yes, Your Honor. That is in part our that is one of our arguments as to why the implied covenant does not adhere in this circumstance. It goes further than that. The stockholders' agreement gave shareholders and indirectly the warrant holders who also agreed through their warrants to become shareholders if they exercised. And remember, these warrants were exercisable at any time. They could have exercised their rights and become stockholders, but that entailed a risk that the plaintiffs didn't want to take. They had to pay $10.
So you were making your second argument, but you've interrupted it with a long parenthetical.
I apologize, Your Honor. And there are two contracts at issue. So there's both the shareholders' agreement that rights are triggered on a change in control. The exchange transaction that the plaintiffs are claiming to have the right to have been able to participate in did not trigger a change in control. That is uncontested, and the plaintiffs have conceded here today that they're not asserting that. So you have to then look to the warrant agreement, and the warrant agreement also gives the plaintiff certain rights in the anti-destruction provision to participate, that kicks in the event of certain transactions.
Right. Let's keep to one side the anti-destruction provision, because that's a separate claim. So you're saying the tag-along provision doesn't apply, and the change of control provision in the shareholders' agreement doesn't apply.
Correct.
And therefore, there's no room to imply a covenant to perform in good faith in these circumstances.
That's correct, because they specifically negotiated and defined the parameters over what types of transactions the plaintiffs would be able to participate in.
Is there anything further to your position on that claim, that is on count one?
Well, there is, Your Honor, because the way the court analyzed it below, in order to imply a covenant, you have to look at what are the express terms of the contracts that are at issue. And what the court did first was it looked at the terms of the warrants and whether or not the anti-destruction clause was triggered by an exchange transaction that happened.
You're going back to the anti-destruction clause.
Let's go back to my question. In my hypothetical where I said you could put two out of the five warrant holders and do business with them, that seems to be your position. But what your opponent is saying is once the warrants were created, if you were going to do anything with holders of the warrants, you had to do it with all of them. Now, why isn't their position correct? That if you're really going to be fair to all of the warrant holders, you can't pick two out of the line and say, we'll let you exchange your warrants for this new venture, but the three of you stay there.
Again, Your Honor, you come back to the terms of the contracts that the parties had, and the parties negotiated over what rights the plaintiffs would get, the plaintiffs being the warrant holders, to participate in transactions. The anti-destruction provision defines those rights in terms of mergers, reorganizations, and other transactions that are covered under that. And the shareholders agreement similarly defines their right to participate in change in control transactions and the like. And by narrowly defining those types of transactions, the parties necessarily excluded other types of transactions like the exchange.
But what they're arguing is, if we get to your second argument in the anti-destruction, that was one way of creating a market for the warrants by, going with a merger. But they're saying to the extent you put together step one and you basically afforded an opportunity to any holders of warrants, you had to afford it to everyone. Why is that argument incorrect? As I understand your answer, it is because in the four corners of the document, you don't find any reference that all people will be taken along no matter what just because they hold warrants.
That's true, Your Honor, and I think, as Vice Chancellor Strine pointed out in his opinion, these, shareholders and warrant holders are free to sell their interests. That's exactly what happened here. These parties who were not bound otherwise not to sell their shares, participate in a transaction by which Mr. Anschutz and his entities consolidated control over these similarly situated companies and in order to achieve efficiencies and the like.
Just to vary Justice Holland's question, suppose Mr. Anschutz decided that he was going to do a cash-out merger of the minority. But he wasn't going to cash out everyone. He was going to take his favored warrant holders and exempt them from the costs of being cashed out at $14 a share, which let's assume is below fair value. And he decided to do that by simply including them in this Regal deal, which made them security holders in a different entity that went public at a very nice price, certainly more than $14. Can he do that under these governing documents?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not sure that I followed the beginning part, whether you're implying, you know, could they have negotiated an agreement to that effect, or do you mean under these?
I mean, under the agreements that were negotiated, could Mr. Anschutz do that with the intent that I've attributed to it?
Your Honor, again, I guess, you know, if you're saying if he had a sort of a malicious intent to cash someone out at less than fair value, I would go back again to the governing agreements, and I would look at those agreements, and I would say the parties negotiated over certain types of transactions, and if they didn't get that right, if it's not in the four corners of the documents in this case, then I would say no, that they would not be entitled to get that.
Well, the analogy that Justice Jacobs' questions raises is really the origin of this good faith and fair dealing in Pressman versus DuPont. You remember in that case, someone was hired basically as an employee at will, and they relocated their family, left the job, and came in what they thought was good faith. And then they were terminated, and the facts as they unraveled showed there was never an intention to hire this person on a long-term basis as long as they did a good job. And the doctrine as enunciated by this court was that wasn't good faith and fair dealing even in a contract that was otherwise terminable at will. And the question that follows from Justice Jacobs' question to you is, if someone put the warrants in place intending to rearrange the composition of the warrant holders to achieve the result here, and that was the original intent, would that be a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
And Your Honor, again, I would step back and say, one, those aren't the facts here, but you know, here the parties have specific control. It's not like the Pressman case where there was no express contract before the court at issue. Here you had sophisticated parties who defined what their rights and obligations were as between them. That's exactly the case we have here, and they did negotiate over specific provisions that dealt with what would happen in particular types of transactions.
So your position is, and this, I don't say this in a disparaging way, is that if sophisticated parties bargain at arm's length and reduce their understanding to writing, the legal operation should be enforceable, and in this particular case, there's no reason to superimpose any equitable principles.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. That is our position.
Even fiduciary duty principles? Let's not forget that Mr. Anschutz, as the majority stockholder, was a fiduciary.
He was a fiduciary to stockholders.
And if he is in his fiduciary capacity, decided to cash out the minority on terms that let's assume were unfair, and to make things worse, decided that he would exempt from that transaction his friends who own some but not all of the warrants, would that not violate a fiduciary principle?
It potentially could, Your Honor, to stockholders, to someone to whom he had owed fiduciary duties. If he had, in this case, actually, Your Honor,
the answer is yes.
If you had a circumstance where Mr. Anschutz, or the majority stockholder in this instance, had done something unfair in connection with the merger,
He is a majority stockholder. He intends to do something unfair. He does something unfair, but only to some but not all of the minority. Is that a violation of a fiduciary duty?
Again, in the context of a squeeze-out merger, Your Honor, no, under Glassman versus Unical. The stockholder's exclusive remedy in that circumstance would be appraisal. That in Delaware is now settled law. So the stockholder's only claim in that context, if there was some, you know, fairness, would be, you know, appraisal would be their exclusive remedy.
Well, assume he got to 89% and not 90, then tell me what your answer would be.
If there were some element of unfairness, absolutely, he would owe fiduciary duties to the stockholders, and in theory, those stockholders could bring a claim for breach of fiduciary duty of entire fairness.
Well, 35 minutes ago, I thought I understood this case. Now I'm not at all sure that I do. Was there any fiduciary duty claim made in the, before the trial court?
Your Honor, there was in the original complaint. The defendants moved to dismiss that based on the well-settled law that directors, they originally sued the entire board of United Artists, claiming that they breached, the board had breached its fiduciary duties to the warrant holders, and citing Glennard and many other cases.
Well, there's no discussion of the claim in the opinion because it was eventually abandoned.
When we moved to dismiss the original complaint, the plaintiffs filed an amended complaint dropping the fiduciary duty claims entirely. So those are out of the case. They're gone.
And the implication here is that despite the fact that the argument was all couched arising out of a contract, that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing is an equitable remedy or an equitable claim arising out of a contract and not something that could or, well, should have been dealt with when the contract was negotiated?
I believe that's certainly the plaintiff's position in this case, that they're using the implied covenant. And I think Justice Jacobs may have asked the question that in essence they're using the implied covenant here to get around the fact that they don't have fiduciary duty claims, which they've already given up on and dismissed because they realized that the law was against them.
And you agree that that's an equitable claim and not a contract claim?
The implied covenant claim, I believe, is a contract. I believe it's a contract claim, though. I don't agree with that it's purely an equitable claim. I believe it is a contract claim. It's a contract theory.
Well, as I understand it, where we are with step two is we all agree there are no fiduciary duties to the holders of warrants. And consequently, what we're really focusing on is the language in the warrants to determine whether or not the warrant holders got the functional equivalent of an appraisal. And as the exchange with Mr. Kreiner and Justice Jacobs showed, one of the concerns the Vice Chancellor has was the warrant holders are contending they have the best of all worlds. They can take the money and then pursue this equivalent of an appraisal right when no other shareholder could have done it without making an election. And so as I understand, your position is that what they contracted for were words that didn't include this remedy. And if they wanted a remedy like that, as the Vice Chancellor said, they should have written the warrants differently.
Absolutely, Honor. That is our position 100%. There are other elements to our position as well. But that, I think, in essence, captures our position on the warrant adjustment provisions. Appraisal rights or this concept of sort of the amorphous concept of a fair value determination outside of appraisal is clearly not something that's dealt with in the agreement. Appraisal rights are something, appraisal rights are a creature of statute. Those are for stockholders only. These plaintiffs never exercised their warrants to become stockholders, even though they could have at any time.
Well, do you agree or disagree with the proposition that the purpose or a purpose of the anti-destruction clause of the warrant was to place the warrant holder in the same position as a stockholder had the warrant been exercised immediately before the merger?
I don't agree with that as you put it, Your Honor. I mean, the purpose of the anti-destruction clause is to put the stockholder in the position of a stockholder so that they could be treated the same way any stockholder is treated.
You mean put a warrant holder
in the same position as a stockholder. Here, the language of the warrant agreement is clear that you're entitled to receive such shares, securities, or property that the stockholders would have received upon consummation of the transaction that triggered the event.
But the transaction in this case had as part, legally as part of its terms, the right to seek an appraisal.
That's
at least
correct.
if the security holder were a stockholder.
That's correct. Stockholders
so on, on what principle basis can your side, let us assume, cash out the warrant holders at an, again, alleged unfair price and yet deny them the very right to seek appraisal that a stockholder would have?
Your Honor,
indeed, that would be the only right the stockholder would have.
That is true. That is the only right the stockholder would have in a short-form merger like this one. And the answer to that is, I guess, twofold. One is the warrant holders themselves had the right at any time to become stockholders. They chose not to elect to exercise that right and take the risk of becoming a stockholder.
Well, my last question before you sit down is, why isn't the right to seek an appraisal a property right of a shareholder?
Your Honor, I think two reasons. One is appraisal is, again, a creature of statute. That's something that the legislature has defined very narrowly. The statute expressly defines a stockholder as a stockholder of record in the company.
But in this case, if I was a shareholder, not a warrant holder, but a shareholder, and I sought an appraisal, I could assign that right to someone else, and they could pursue that on my behalf, couldn't they? Isn't that, I mean, wouldn't that make it look like a property right?
Your Honor, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, whether they could or couldn't assign that right to somebody else. I question whether they could because of the way the statute is defined. If you could assign and trade, you know, rights that are granted by the legislature, I'd be surprised. I'm not aware of any authority that would support that concept. But I think more importantly, Your Honor had pointed out before, if the parties who, again, their words, these were highly contentious negotiations. Had the parties intended to grant such rights, this contract would have been written fundamentally differently. And it would have, there would have been some articulation of how do you exercise those rights, what circumstances, what the methodology would be, all of those things that the trial court pointed out in its opinion.
Thank you, Mr.
Your Honor. Thank you.
Please, the court, I have one brief point to make, and it's with respect to the tag-along rights. The tag-along rights in the stockholders' agreement apply to stock and not to the warrants. To the extent that they indicate any evidence of the intent of the parties in negotiating the contracts that went into this transaction, the appellants submit that the tag-along rights are effectively to protect minority stockholders in a sale of control. That is, on a sale of control where Mr. Anschutz got out of the company or got out to the extent that he no longer held at least control of 25%, that all of the stockholders would be entitled to participate pro rata. The appellants suggest that that indicates an intent to share any control premium as opposed to the transaction that was structured in this way in two steps to allocate the control premium essentially to the favored holders.
Colonel, would you answer one question for me, please?
Certainly.
Tell me at the bottom of page 28 of the Vice Chancellor's opinion when he says, therefore, there is no basis on which to find that the plaintiffs have received anything other than the same merger consideration they would have obtained had they exercised their warrants before the merger. Why is that sort of summing up of the equity of this case incorrect?
Your Honor, if a stockholder, if the warrant holder had exercised his warrants prior to the short form, the appellants contend that the stockholder would have been able to seek appraisal and obtain more. And under the facts of this case, as we've alleged, we think that the fair value of United Artists was clearly far in excess of the $14 per share, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a short recess. Thank you for your argument, counsel.